This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of Rifles for Waity by Harold Keefe. Narrated by Tom Stecksholte.
Chapter 1. Linn County, Kansas, 1861. The mules strained forward strongly, hoofs stomping, harness jingling. The iron blade of the plow sang joyously as it ripped up the moist black Kansas earth with a soft crunching sound, turning it over in long, smooth, root-veined rectangles. Leather lines tied together over his left shoulder and under his right arm, Jeff trudged along behind the plow, watching the fresh dirt cascade off the blade and remembering. Remembering the terrible Kansas drought of the year before, when it hadn't rained for 16 long months. The ground had broken open in great cracks. Springs and wells went dry, and no green plant would grow except the curly buffalo grass, which never failed. That drought had been hard on everybody. Jeff clutched the wooden plow handles and thought about it. He recalled how starved he had been for wheat bread, and how his longing for it grew so acute that on Sundays he found excuse to visit neighbor after neighbor in hopes of being invited to share a pan of hot biscuits, only to discover that they, too, took their cornbread 3 times a day. A drop of perspiration trickled down his tanned, dusty face. It was a pleasant face, with a wide, generous mouth, a deep dimple in the chin, and quick brown eyes that crinkled with good humor. The sweat droplets ran uncomfortably into the corner of his mouth, tasting salty and warm. But now, the drought was broken. After plenty of snow and rain, the new land was blooming again. Even his mother was learning to accept Kansas. Edith Bussey had lived all her life in Kentucky, with its gently rolling hills, its seas of bluegrass, its stone fences festooned with honeysuckle, and its stately homes with their tall white columns towering into the drowsy air. No wonder she found the new Kansas country hard to like. She had called Kansas an erratic land. Jeff remembered she had said it was like a child, happy and laughing one minute, hateful and contrary the next. A land famous for its cyclones, blizzards, grasshoppers, mortgages, and its violently opposed political cliques. Jeff ducked his head and wiped his mouth on the sleeve of his homespun shirt, never taking his eyes off the mules. He'd never forget the scores of covered wagons he had seen during the drought last fall. On the Murdazine Road that went past his father's farm, as 1/3 of the 100,000 people living in Kansas Territory gave up, abandoning their claims and heading back to their wives' folks. Curious, he had leaned on his father's corral fence of peeled cottonwood logs and asked some of them where they were going. "Back to Illinois," or "back to Indiana," they replied in their whining, sing-song voices. "Don't want to starve to death here." Although Jeff had felt sorry for them and their families, his father, a veteran of the Mexican War, was disgusted with their faint-heartedness. Emory Bussey believed that in one respect the drought had been a blessing to the new state. "We got rid of the chronic croakers who never could see good in anything," he maintained. Emory was a free state man in the raging guerrilla warfare over slavery that had divided people on the Kansas-Missouri border into free and slave factions. It was a political dispute that was far more serious than the drought. Jeff yelled at the mules and whistled piercingly between his teeth to keep them going. He liked the new Kansas country. He meant not only to live and work in it, but also to go to college in it. His father had told him that the first Kansas Constitution, made in 1855, contained a provision saying that the General Assembly may take measures for the establishment of a university. Jeff wondered if the drought would delay its coming. At the end of the row, he halted the mules. He took off his hat to cool his brown head. His mother had made the hat from wheat straw she had plaited with her own hands at night, shaping the crown to his head and lining it inside with cloth to keep it from being scratchy. While Jeff stood bareheaded, enjoying the warm breeze blowing through his hair, his dog Ring trotted up, panting, and nudged Jeff's leg affectionately. Jeff reached down and pulled Ring's ears, and the big gray dog's plumed tail waved in slow half-circles of delight. Ring was half-shepherd and half-greyhound. He had big shoulder muscles and a white ring around his neck. Although the dog weighed almost 90 pounds now, Jeff recalled how 6 years ago he had brought him home in his coat pocket. His father and mother hadn't wanted him to have a dog. They already had a collie and a feist. But Jeff begged so hard that they relented on condition that he keep the animal at the barn. However, that first night, Jeff had heard the pup crying lonesomely for its mother. He slipped out of bed in the dark, walked to the barn, and brought the pup back to his bedroom. The next morning, his father and mother discovered the dog in bed with him. When they scolded him, Jeff hung his head and took his reprimand without speaking. Now, he and Ring were such good friends that Jeff couldn't wrestle with the other boys at the 3 months district school without Ring taking his part. He put his hands back on the plow handles and looked around, smelling the freshly turned sod. The morning was alive with a soft stirring and a dewy crispness. Jeff heard the sharp, friendly whistle of a quail from the waving blue stem beyond the plowed space, and from somewhere in the warm south wind, his nostrils caught the wild, intoxicating whiff of sand plum blossoms. But the boy felt strangely out of tune with the beauty and freshness of the morning. His mind was filled with a restlessness and a yearning. At breakfast, his father had told him that 6 southern states had seceded from the Union and that a war would probably be fought between the North and the South, a big war that might easily spread to Kansas. Jeff's heart beat faster beneath his blue homespun shirt. If by a miracle a general war could be avoided, soldiers were still needed to halt the guerrilla warfare in Kansas, brought on by the Missouri pro-slavery faction across the border. Jeff's dearest wish was to become a soldier. It was all he talked about at home. He was small for his 16 years, but strong, wiry, cheerful, and not at all abashed in the presence of strangers. There was no doubt in his mind which army he wanted to enlist in. He had known ever since that time he and his father had ridden horseback through the snow in the winter of 1859 to Leavenworth to hear Abraham Lincoln speak in behalf of his candidacy for the presidency. Lincoln had just touched the northeast tip of the new Kansas Territory on his tour, speaking at Elwood, Troy, Doniphan, Atchison, Stockton, and Leavenworth. Jeff never forgot him. He could still repeat from memory portions of Lincoln's speech he had heard. The day was bitterly cold. Lincoln and his party had traveled in sleighs and were wrapped in buffalo robes. Before the meeting, Jeff saw Lincoln's kindly face and his rangy profile through the window of a Leavenworth barber shop. Conducted there by Kansas City newspaper men to get his hair cut, Lincoln was reading the New York and Chicago newspapers they had bought for him at the post office newsstand while he waited his turn in the chair. Later, the cold prairie wind rocked the little bare-walled courthouse in which Lincoln spoke. Not more than 40 people were present. Jeff was surprised when the tall lawyer from Illinois rose up behind a rough table and, with his long hands wandering awkwardly in and out of his pantaloon pockets, began in a tenor voice freely punctuated with gist and sitch, not to orate, but just to talk. At first Jeff had squirmed in his seat. If the people of Illinois considered this a great man, their ideas must be peculiar. Despite his youth, Jeff knew a lot about slavery. It was all his father discussed at mealtime. But as Lincoln talked on and on, Jeff began to change his mind about the gangling visitor from Illinois. Speaking as informally as though he and another man were exchanging thoughts while driving a buggy across the prairie, Lincoln discussed the question of slavery in the territories with kindly but naked frankness. Although Jeff's father had told Jeff that Leavenworth was a slavery town, the frontier people there believed in fair play, and Jeff noticed that they listened courteously to Lincoln. Jeff never forgot one thing Lincoln told the pro-slavery audience.
"Your own statement of it is that if the black Republicans elect a president, you won't stand it. You will break up the Union. Do you really think you're justified to break up the government? If you do, you are very unreasonable, and more reasonable men cannot and will not submit to you. If we shall constitutionally elect a president, it will be our duty to see that you submit. We have a means provided for expressing our belief in regard to slavery. It is through the ballot box, the peaceful method provided by the Constitution. But no man, North or South, can approve of violence or crime."
Relaxing against the plow, Jeff frowned and fanned himself with his hat. Every family living along the Kansas-Missouri border knew all about the violence and crime that had arisen over slavery. Jeff was growing tired of it. 3 years earlier, a band of armed Missouri border ruffians had captured 11 free state men, marched them to a gulch only 11 miles from the Bussey home, lined them up, and fired a volley, killing 5. Jeff's father had ridden over next day to help bury them. Jeff had begged to go along, but his mother wouldn't hear of it. That was known as the Mare d'Azyn Massacre. Jeff put his hat back on his head and remembered the time 2 months ago his younger sisters Bess and Mary had ridden horseback to the trading post to buy an ounce of paregoric. 2 miles from home, they were surprised by 5 Missouri bushwhackers. The men took their horses, but the girls persuaded them to let them keep their light saddles. Later they arrived home carrying the saddles. The stolen horses were the only ones the family possessed. One of them was Charlie, Jeff's own 3-year-old, whom he had raised from a colt. In spite of Lincoln's speech, violence and crime over slavery still flared all along the border, just 3 miles from the Bussey home. And now there was going to be a war over it. Jeff turned the mules, lifting the plow into alignment for the new furrow. He slapped the lines along the mules' backs and whistled shrilly. Crouching, the mules hit their collars together, leg muscles flexing. The leather traces tightened, creaked, strained. Grunting laboriously, they dug in and pulled hard, and Jeff felt the handles drawn almost out of his hands as the plow moved forward, hurling the black dirt off the mold board and pulverizing it into the previous furrow. The sun climbed higher and higher. He plowed for 2 more hours, then paused again to rest his team. He looked up, feeling strong pangs of hunger. Must be about noon. His home, 1/2 mile away, was a handsome 3-room log house with a lean-to barn and a sod smokehouse, nestling snugly in a clearing surrounded by oak, hickory, and blackjack. A column of gray smoke curled from the stone fireplace, and Jeff knew his mother was busy cooking among her pots and ovens there. There would be fat bacon, cornbread in pone, dandelion greens, wild honey, and fried onions from the new garden. Jeff sighed resignedly. No dinner for him today. His mother had packed a big piece of cold corn pone and given him a bottle of water from the spring. But, boy-like, he had eaten all the pone at 10 o'clock in the morning, and now he was hungry again. Jeff was proud of his home. It had taken the family 7 months to build it. 7 long months of hewing, beveling, chinking, daubing, and plastering. Although Jeff had been small, he had helped, working long hours. So had his mother and his sisters. How pleased they all were to see the new house rising, log by log. They were tired of living in the dugout down by the creek. The new home was solidly constructed of hickory logs, warmly chinked with clay. The floor was of split logs. The wall had been plastered cleanly with clay mud. The house was comfortable and weather-tight. although his father referred to it as my mud dauber's nest. Its oak-shaped roof turned the hardest rains. Jeff thought it the finest home in Linn County. However, lately he felt a vague fear and insecurity about it. His father's views on slavery were so pronounced that Jeff was afraid their home place might someday be the target for a raid by the pro-slavery bushwhackers from Missouri. Jeff frowned. He wished the Missouri bushwhackers would live by the rule Mr. Lincoln had laid down in his speech at Leavenworth. He could remember almost word for word the president's counsel. If I might advise my Republican friends here, I would say to them, leave your Missouri neighbors alone. Have nothing whatever to do with their slaves. Have nothing whatever to do with the white people, save in a friendly way. Drop past differences and so conduct yourselves that if you cannot be at peace with them, the fault shall be wholly theirs. But neither side had heeded Lincoln's gentle advice. Jeff towed the warm black soil thoughtfully. If war came, he meant to join the Union volunteers, already in training at Fort Leavenworth. He wanted to be in the cavalry. But David Gardner, a neighbor boy who, like Jeff, talked of little else but joining the Union volunteers, said you couldn't get into the cavalry unless you brought your own horse. Jeff frowned again. He didn't have a horse now. All he had was his father's mules, and that reminded him that he had better get on with the plowing. All afternoon, he hustled the mules and steered the plow. With pride and satisfaction, he saw the tilled space behind him bulge larger and larger. Soon the sun began to slant toward the west, and Jeff saw his shadow lengthen across the field. Ring had long since stopped following him and was lying in the shade of a fresh furrow, waiting for him to make another round of the field. When the plow passed, Ring got up, whined, and followed for a few steps. Then he went back and lay in the shade. Suddenly, Jeff's ears caught a sound that made him jerk the mules to a stop in the middle of the field. It was a thin, muted toot of his father's large sea horn. It was only blown in an emergency. Worried, Jeff thought he saw men and horses in the yard. A chill of fear ran through him. Bushwhackers. Quickly he unhooked the traces, leaving the plow in the field. With Ring following at a puzzled lope, Jeff turned the harnessed mules homeward, driving them ahead of him at a trot, and holding on to the lines as he ran behind. Chapter 2 Bushwhackers. Jeff guided the mules into the corral and, without removing their harness, quickly looped the gate's homemade leather clasp over the cottonwood post and hurried to the house. He saw his father coming with his awkward limp from the garden. 2 years before, Emery had dropped an anvil on his foot, laming it permanently. That was why Jeff was doing the plowing. Jeff's mother, small, frightened, and pretty, was standing on the rock porch with two rough-looking, whiskery strangers who carried sawed-off Enfield muskets. Blue ribbons were fastened to their hats and fluttered from the bridles of their horses. Bess, elder of Jeff's sisters, had slipped out the front door and blown the sea horn.
"Good morning," said the smaller and dirtier of the two strangers, although it was then late in the afternoon. "Is this the Emery Bussey place?"
Jeff's father nodded curtly.
"I'm Emery Bussey."
The smaller man looked significantly at his companion, as though to say, "This is our man." Then he whipped his brown eyes back upon Jeff's father, regarding him insolently from head to foot.
"We're two of Cy Gordon's Union Home Guards. We want something to eat," he said.
Emery Bussey stood in his backyard, his legs apart, staring coldly at them.
"That's a lie," he said boldly. "You're not Union." "But I never turn anybody away that's hungry. Go on into the house, and I'll have him get you something."
Jeff caught his breath. He was proud of his father's fearlessness, but afraid of what it might bring. With a start, he thought of the family rifle, but remembered it was standing unloaded in the corner of the house. The small man's jaw sagged with surprise. Again he stared at Emery, and this time there was rude cunning in his rough face. The larger man stood silently behind him. Without a word, Jeff's mother and the girls stepped inside to prepare the meal. Emery said coolly, "Jeff, better go unharness the mules." Then he turned to the strangers and, with a brief motion of his head, gestured toward the door, indicating they should go inside. Spurs clanking, the men tied their horses to a small cottonwood tree and strode inside the house, still carrying their guns and wearing their hats. Emery hobbled after them. Uneasy, Jeff watched them over his shoulder as he walked to the barn. He didn't trust them. Trembling with helplessness, he wished he had the rifle. He feared for his father's life. But obedience was strong within him. His father had told him to unharness the mules. All the time he worked, his mind was in a turmoil. He wished with all his heart he could think of some way to help, but he was too excited to think. He picked up the mules' halter ropes and tied them to the stalls while they ate. He was halfway out the barn door when he heard Bess scream and saw her run from the house and climb over the wooden stile they had erected so the women could cross the fence. She was crying hysterically.
"They're going to shoot Father," she gasped.
Jeff looked at her, feeling his body go rigid. He began running toward the house. Bess flung herself upon him, holding him. Although she was only 14, she was strong.
"No, Jeff," she begged. "They'll kill you, too."
Jeff jerked roughly away from her. "I'll follow them even if they crawl into a hole," he vowed hoarsely. As he passed the barn, he grabbed a small curved haying hook off a wooden peg. Ring was close on his heels, a low growl in his throat. Jeff burst into the house. His mother and Mary were cowering along the wall. With a gasp of thankfulness, he realized his father was still unharmed. Emery Bussey was sitting in a chair, defiantly facing the two strangers who stood pointing their guns at his breast. Jeff's mother was pleading with him not to shoot him.
"You're under arrest," the small man growled menacingly. "Come on, outdoors."
Emery Bussey shook his head firmly. He said, "If you want to kill me, you'll have to do it right here in my own house, because I'm not going with you." Jeff felt his breathing quicken. He gripped the haying hook in his right hand.
"Let him alone,"
he warned, with hoarse fierceness. The big bushwhacker swung his musket around, covering Jeff. The smaller bushwhacker took a threatening step forward, his musket still covered Emery's breast.
"Get up on your feet," he ordered,
striking Emery roughly on the shoulder with one hand and nodding with his head toward the door. Emery braced himself in his chair and looked defiantly at them. The two bushwhackers glanced uncertainly at each other, as if debating their next move. Suddenly, hoofbeats clattered in the backyard, rang down the kite track, and were gone. Scornfully, Emery glared at the Missouri border ruffians.
"That's my daughter, Bess. She's gone for help. In 5 minutes' time, there'll be a dozen Free State men hot on your trail. I wouldn't give a nickel for your chances."
Jeff wondered where Bess had summoned the courage to ride one of the wild Bussey mules bareback. An insane glow burned in the face of the smaller man. Holding his rusty musket at hip level, he pulled the trigger. But there was only a loud metallic snap as the cartridge refused to fire. Jeff yelled in a strangled voice and hurled the sharp haying hook at the man with all his strength. Struck in the chest, the bushwhacker dropped his gun. Before he could pick it up, the boy leaped clear across the room and flung himself upon the man, striking him in the face with doubled fists, flooding him with sharp punches. Jeff was the best bare-knuckle fighter in his school, and the spat, spat, spat of his quick blows staggered his adversary. But now the other bushwhacker came forward. Using his gun barrel as a club, He stepped behind Jeff and swung it viciously downward across the boy's head. Clonk! 1,000 colored lights exploded in Jeff's skull. With a low groan, he collapsed unconscious on the floor. Now, the whole Bussy family entered the fight. Jeff's mother reached for a plate of boiled greens and hurled them at the smaller man. The dish and its contents stained his shirt green and flowed down his rough trousers. Emery Bussy stood and, brandishing a small stool, advanced around the table. Both bushwhackers retreated. A sudden howl of pain broke from the larger man as Mary, Jeff's 12-year-old sister, snatched up a pan of hot dishwater from the fireplace and threw it on him. They stumbled out the back door. But their troubles weren't over. As they emerged from the house, the dog Ring, growling fiercely, fastened his strong teeth onto the seat of the bigger man's trousers. With a superhuman effort, the man got one foot in the stirrup of his excited horse and tried to mount with the 90-pound dog anchored to his pants. Luckily for him, the cloth ripped noisily, and when Ring fell to the ground on his back, both men were able to gain their saddles.
"We'll be back," the smaller one threatened. "There's 30 men in our band, and they're close by. We'll burn your house down and string you all up by the necks, you Free State scum."
But the rest of his threat was lost, as Ring, scrambling to his feet, threw himself so fiercely at the heels of the horses that the frightened animals stampeded down the kite track, with their riders hard-pressed to stay in their saddles. The Bussies could tell by Ring's gradually diminishing cries that the dog chased them nearly a quarter mile down the road. When Jeff awakened, he was lying on a hard, dirt floor. Wrinkling his nose, he thought he smelled smoked bacon. It was a nice smell, salty and pungent. He could hear water dripping faintly onto a metal pan. The sound was familiar, and he finally recognized it. It was cold water from the spring striking the pan covering the cream crock. Then Jeff knew he was in the smokehouse. His mother kept her milk and butter there. Sighing, he relaxed. It was dark and cool on the smokehouse floor. Opening his eyes, he saw the whole family clustered anxiously around him. His mother was bathing his face with cold water from the spring. His father's arm was under his neck as, with another cold cloth, he made a compress for the long red welt across Jeff's scalp.
"Oh," Jeff groaned. "Water's running down inside my ear."
Relieved to hear his voice, the Bussy family began to laugh and chatter. Jeff thought he heard horses whinnying and pawing the ground outside. When he could focus his eyes better, he looked around and saw not only his own family, but also a couple of Free State neighbors standing in the background, rifles in their hands. Bess had summoned them with her plucky ride. He grinned weakly at her.
"Thanks, sis," he mumbled. "You did even better than Paul Revere. He didn't have to ride no mule."
Taking a long breath, the boy sat up and looked at his father, his face serious and determined.
"Pa," Jeff said earnestly, "the Missourians aren't going to let us alone. I'm sick and tired of their meanness, stealing our horses from Bess and Mary, trying to kill you in your own home, belting me over the head with a gun. We've got to organize and fight 'em or give 'em the whole country. And I'm tired of fighting them with just a hay sickle, Pa. I want to go to Fort Leavenworth tomorrow and join the volunteers."
Emery Bussy looked fondly at his son. His eyes blurred, and he stared dully out the smokehouse door at the log home they had built with their own hands and the fields they had broken and planted at such hard labor. This was reality to him. All he had in the world was here. His farm, his family, and his son, especially his son. Emery swallowed hard. He much preferred going to war himself,
Then he dropped his eyes helplessly to his crippled foot.
All right, son. I'll write out my consent. You shall go tomorrow.
Quietly, Jeff's mother began to sob. Rising, she stumbled toward the door, dabbing at her eyes with her apron. It was hard to give up one's firstborn. Jeff had come into the world back in Kentucky when she was a girl wife of 17. With him to care for, life on the new Kansas farm hadn't been so lonely when Emery was gone all day working in the field. With all the tenderness a mother could muster, she had fed, bathed, and cared for Jeff, loving his bright, cheerful ways, nursing him through his boyhood diseases, teaching him the biblical precepts of decency and kindness. And now he was to be wrenched from her.
"Don't cry, Mama," Jeff said, embarrassed at her tears in front of the neighbors. "I won't be gone long. This war's just a breakfast spell. I don't want it to end before I get there."
Bess moved quietly to her mother's side, put her arms around her, and tried to comfort her as they walked together to the house. Chapter 3 Fort Leavenworth. Jeff walked briskly up the wagon road toward Fort Leavenworth. It was early in the morning, and much of the dewy trail still lay in shadow. Beneath his dusty brogans, the road was like a treadmill holding him back. It seemed to him he kept passing the same clumps of sumac and hearing the same crickets chirping from the bluestem. He was bursting to get to the fort. Soon the land became lower and flatter and rockier. Ahead of him, Jeff saw the Chadwick farm with its small log barn, its lean-to smithy, and the smoke from its breakfast fire coiling from the small rock chimney of the two-room slab-sided cabin where the family lived. Big John Chadwick was standing by the family woodpile, his arms full of small blackjack logs. His black hair was awry. Jeff waved at him, hoping John wouldn't delay him by wanting to stop and talk. But John stared with amazement at the light bandage running over Jeff's head and under his chin.
"What's that? Toothache?"
Jeff laughed.
"Bushwhackers," he corrected. "Two of them raided us last night. Big one busted me over the head with the barrel of his musket."
John whistled in astonishment. Still carrying his arm full of wood, he walked alongside Jeff, staring with fascination at the bandage.
"Don't it hurt?"
he asked.
"Nah," laughed Jeff. "My head's hard. He's lucky he didn't bust his gun barrel." "How's all your folks? Anybody get hurt?"
Shaking his head, Jeff related the whole incident. He concluded by telling John he was on his way to Fort Leavenworth to enlist. John puckered his mouth to whistle a second time, then closed it as an idea came to him. Excited, he began to blink his china blue eyes. Cautiously, he looked back over his shoulder at his home.
"Believe I'll go with you, Jeff. I was going to enlist at Sugar Mound anyhow, but I'd rather go with you."
Jeff was glad to have company. Then his face clouded.
"Yes, but how about your folks? Aren't you going to tell them?"
John squared his chin defiantly.
"They'll know I've gone to the army when I don't bring back the wood. We've been fussing about it for the last 6 weeks. Pa says he'll tan me if I ask him again. So I'll just go without asking him. He don't need me here nohow. He's got my two brothers to help him lay by the crops. I'm 18 year old now, and I want to see the world. I'm a-goin'."
And dropping the armful of wood on the chip-strewn ground at his feet, he brushed the shavings off his shirt and joined Jeff on the military road. They walked half a mile. The rising sun began to warm them a little. The road became crooked and rocky. Soon they passed the humble home of David Gardner, whose place was located in a woodsy area near the stone quarry. David lived with his mother and three smaller brothers and sisters. His father had died 3 years earlier from typhoid. Their lot was hard. David was hoeing the runtish corn that grew so reluctantly in the flinty soil. He was freckled and red-haired, save for his heavy eyebrows, which were white as corn silk. David stared, too, at the light bandage, plainly visible under Jeff's chin.
"Gosh almighty, Jeff, what happened?"
he asked, leaning on his hoe.
"Bushwhackers," Jeff replied. "Two of them raided us last night. Big one hit me over the head with his musket."
He was eager to be on his way. David almost dropped the hoe.
"You mean he fetched you a full clout with his gun barrel and you're still alive?"
Jeff grinned.
"My head's hard. You ought to see the gun barrel. They had to put splints on it." "Gosh almighty!" David exclaimed again and begged for more details.
Patiently, Jeff explained everything that happened. When he told David that he and John were on their way to Fort Leavenworth to join the Kansas Volunteers, David promptly tossed his hoe back into the field. It hit on the end of its long handle and bounced high into the air.
"I'm going, too," David announced, stepping to Jeff's side. "I'm 16, Jeff. Same as you. That's old enough."
Jeff blinked. At the rate he was recruiting, he'd have himself a regiment before he ever reached the fort. He eased his pack. It contained the lunch his mother had fixed and the extra shirts and pants she had washed and ironed after he went to bed. His father had given him a silver dollar, all the cash money he had in the world.
"Corin, Dave, aren't you going to tell your mother?" Jeff asked.
He knew that if David went to war, Mrs. Gardner would have to plow, plant, and harvest in the fields, as well as milk the cow and do her housework.
"Nah,"
David replied scornfully, throwing a careless look over his shoulder at the mean little one-roomed log home.
"If I told her, she wouldn't let me go. She says I'm too young."
Jeff still didn't think it was right.
"The least you can do is let her know. She needs you on the farm. Besides, the woods are full of bushwhackers prowling around. She'll think they caught you and hung you in the bushes."
"Let her," David replied unfeelingly.
"Let's go. This is the only way I'll ever get to leave. Let's go by the spring first and get a drink."
They walked under the trees. When they reached the Gardner Spring, they came up behind Bobby, David's 6-year-old brother. He was on his knees busily shaping mud pies at the plashy edge of the water. David knelt beside him.
"Goodbye, Bobby. Tell Ma I've gone to Fort Leavenworth to enlist in the Volunteers."
Bobby never looked up. With dirty hands, he scooped up another double handful of mud and began calmly to fashion another pie.
"Ma'll skin you, Davy,"
he warned suddenly in his shrill, quavering old man's voice.
"You're not old enough to go to war. You'll get killed, and we'll find your bones bleaching on the prairie."
David snorted. Standing, he looked at Jeff and John, his face red with embarrassment.
"Come on," he said impatiently.
They walked on. Jeff didn't see how David could be so indifferent. His own family leave-taking that morning had been more painful. His mother had cried again. Although Jeff wanted to go to war worse than he had ever wanted anything else in his life, he even felt a little like crying himself, until he got out of sight of the house. That took more time than he had counted on. Ring kept trying to follow, and it was hard to refuse him. Twice Jeff sent him back, but each time the faithful dog returned, showing his savage teeth in a loving grin and frisking all around as though they were playing a game. In a hurry to get started, Jeff had finally thrown rocks at Ring to scare him home, but the dog still hadn't understood. Picking up the rocks in his mouth, he brought them dutifully to Jeff, laid them at his feet, and looked up, tail wagging, waiting for Jeff to pet him. Jeff finally had to take him back and lock him in the barn. Bess volunteered to release him in an hour.
"But I may turn him loose sooner," she warned, sniffing bravely as her tear-stained face broke into a wan smile. "Then you'd have to bring him back and I'd get to see you again."
Jeff felt sorry for Bess and the lonely, humdrum existence his sister would have to live on the farm. He was glad now that David and John were going with him,
He hadn't relished the long trip alone. They walked 15 miles on the military road. Then they rested, eating most of the cold corn pone and potatoes Jeff's mother had sent. In the afternoon, they caught 2 different rides with settlers going northward for provisions. And after sleeping that night at the home of a hospitable farmer, they arrived the next afternoon at Fort Leavenworth, riding the last 20 miles in an Army Teamster's wagon. A husky sentinel stopped them at the fort's stone gate, his gun held diagonally across his chest. The 3 country boys stared with awe at his trim uniform. He wore a blue coat with brass buttons, blue trousers with a yellow braid down the sides, and on his head a little sloping, flat-topped blue cap. Jeff could hardly wait to get one himself. They told him who they were and that they wanted to join the Kansas Volunteers. The sentry admitted them and told them to go to the enrollment officer in Barracks K. The fort, an orderly cluster of neat white buildings, was beautifully situated on rising ground near the southern shore of the Missouri River. Bounded on both sides by dark green strips of woodland, the river flowed southeastward in oceanic grandeur. From his high vantage point, Jeff could see the distant ferry rafts moving slowly across the river, like bugs crawling slowly in the sand. Beyond the river, the light green sweep of the prairie ran endlessly. After being sworn in, the 3 Linn County boys were sent to the military hospital to take their physical examinations. On the way, they passed hundreds of soldiers in blue blouses marching on the spacious green drill fields. Bugles were tooting. Officers crossing the parade ground saluted smartly as they passed one another. Jeff watched with excitement. Apparently, everybody was getting ready to fight. As Jeff, John, and David turned the corner of a barracks building, they heard a thunder of hoofbeats and were almost run down by a squadron of cavalry. Spurs jingling, sabers rattling, and the oaken butts of their carbines resting against their thighs. They thundered past grandly with a drumming of horses' hoofs and a creak of leather. It was quite a sight for a boy fresh from the plow handles. Jeff could smell the horses' sweat and see the metal ring bits on their bridles flashing in the bright Kansas sunshine. He wished he were joining the cavalry instead of the infantry, but the bushwhackers had stolen his horse. At the hospital, the 3 boys were asked to strip to the waist while a gruff old army doctor with a fat paunch and tired eyes examined them. Jeff lined up with the scores of other men and boys awaiting their turns.
"Come on, kid," the old doctor said, finally beckoning to Jeff. "You shall have all the war you want."
"Yes, sir," said Jeff. His father had carefully coached him never to forget that sir as long as he was in the army.
"Huh," grunted the old doctor as he worked. "Lots of fellers nowadays can't wait to put on some blue clothes and go out and shoot at perfect strangers."
Noisily, he spat a stream of brown tobacco juice all over a brass spittoon on the floor behind him and looked suddenly at Jeff.
"Are you one of them?"
"Yes, sir," said Jeff promptly. "I want to shoot at them before they shoot at me." The doctor tapped Jeff's chest roughly with his dirty, horny knuckles and grunted again.
"Huh. That's a pretty good chest."
Jeff beamed modestly.
"Just right for the rebels to shoot mini-balls through," the old doctor added.
Jeff stared at him, feeling strangely depressed. Later, when they put their blouses back on, Jeff told John and David,
"As far as I'm concerned, he could have left out that last remark."
They were surprised still more when they reported to the enlistment officer, and one of the first questions he asked was,
"Where do you want your pay sent if you're captured?"
Pondering the question, Jeff felt better. He'd been afraid the rebels would surrender and the war end before he could get into the fighting. And here was this fellow suggesting he might be captured. Maybe he was going to see some action after all. As they stood in line before the quartermaster, Jeff strained his neck trying to get a look at the new federal uniforms he was sure would be issued to them, like the handsome blue outfit he had seen on the sentry at the fort's gate. But all they got was one light blue blouse, one pair of cotton socks, and one pair of drawers each. The new recruits fell to talking about why they had enlisted.
"I came all the way from Seward County, down near Injun Territory," said one. "My family's Union. Mammy didn't want me to go to no war, but we knowed the bushwhackers was hid out in the brush stealing money and hosses and choking boys my age when they found 'em. I didn't want to get choked, so I runned away. I wanted to run away sooner."
"I jined up for a frolic," laughed a tall fellow from Republic County with warts on his face. He turned to his messmate, a blonde boy from Fort Scott.
"Why'd you come in?"
"Well, but Jack, because I thought the rebels was going to take over the whole country. I joined up because they told me the rebels was cutting out Union folks' tongues and killing their babies. After I got here, I found out all it was over was wanting to free the niggers," complained another, disgustedly.
"I decided I'd just as well be in the army as out in the brush. Now I'm about to decide I'd druther be in the brush," snorted another.
They were nearly all frowsy-headed, boot-shod, and lonely-looking, fresh from the new states, farms, ranches, and raw young prairie towns. Before the war ended, Kansas furnished more men and boys to the Union forces in proportion to its population than any other state, and all of them were volunteers. Jeff smiled to himself and went on eating. He'd heard his father discuss the issue so often that he knew them forward and backward, but he saw no need for injecting them into the conversation here. Besides, he was too busy with his supper. The food was good, and there was lots of it. In bed that night in the barracks, Jeff turned on his stomach and sighed with satisfaction. At last, he was in the army. Chapter 4. Captain Asa Clardy. Next morning, the bugle awakened them early. After breakfast, they were assembled and taken to the drill field. Each man was issued an Enfield rifle and a bayonet. Through an error, Jeff, David, John, and the other late arrivals were assigned to fill out a company that, unknown to them, had already received several days' instruction.
"The captain's a terror," warned the man standing next to Jeff in a whisper. "Name's Asa Clardy. He fought in the Mexican War and hates being outranked here by volunteer officers who were farmers a few weeks ago. He takes it out on us volunteer soldiers."
Jeff dropped the butt of his rifle onto the ground. His father had fought in the Mexican War. Perhaps he knew Clardy. Jeff resolved to ask him next time he rode home.
"Fix bayonets!" roared Captain Clardy.
He was a tall, spare-built man with gray sideburns and a long, irregular scar on his left cheek. The sides of his black shoes were wet with dew. He had the look of a fellow who was always angry about something. Mystified by this command, Jeff, John, David, and the other new recruits never moved. The captain glared and stepped in front of Jeff. Jeff looked at him and felt a quiet shudder. What had he done wrong? On the man's face was a savage, gloating expression.
"Didn't you hear me say fix bayonets?" he demanded.
"Yes, sir," Jeff replied innocently. "But mine isn't broken, sir."
A roar of laughter ran down the line. Jeff reddened with shame.
"Silence!" shouted the captain curtly, "or I'll run you all around the compound."
The officer scourged Jeff with another searching glare.
"What's your name?"
"Jefferson Davis Bussey, sir,"
Jeff replied, speaking in a loud, clear voice as his father had taught him. This time the laughter was more subdued, but again it was plainly audible. The captain's face almost purpled with rage.
"Then change your name," he roared.
Jefferson Davis is the president of the traitorous Southern Confederacy we are now at war with.
Jeff felt the hair rising on the back of his neck. He neither liked the remark nor the man who delivered it.
Sir, he said, looking the captain fearlessly in the eye and continuing to speak loudly, I won't change it. My father gave me that name. He knew Jefferson Davis before the Mexican War. He fought in Jefferson Davis's regiment at the Battle of Buena Vista. Both were serving then under the Stars and Stripes.
Captain Clardy looked as if he was about to explode.
Fall out! He roared at Jeff. I'll teach you to be impertinent. You volunteers never did know your places. You ought to be stripped, lashed to the wheel of a cannon, and flogged with a mule whip.
Jeff stepped forward obediently, supposing he was about to receive the punishment the captain had described. To his surprise, he was punished in a different way. At the captain's order, a private from the regular army escorted Jeff to the main kitchen, where, for an entire week, he was to wash pots and kettles, peel potatoes, and empty swill after he had spent all day at the drill field. Next afternoon, Jeff was made to peel potatoes for Captain Clardy's own mess. As usual, the kitchen workers were discussing the officers in an uncomplimentary light.
"Are you close to Captain Clardy?" one of them asked cautiously.
Jeff laughed.
"I'll say. I peel the same potatoes he eats. Why?"
The man looked evasive and fell silent.
But later, one of the cooks, a muscular man with an American flag tattooed gaudily in red and blue on the inside of his right arm, came up to Jeff when the others had gone.
His name was Sparrow.
"What are you being punished for?" he asked.
Jeff told him about the incident on the drill field. Sparrow sneered.
"Clardy knows he wouldn't dare talk like that to me, or..."
"Or what?" Jeff asked curiously. A cunning look came into Sparrow's swarthy face.
"I'm not going to shoot off my mouth, but I could tell you something about Asa Clardy that he wouldn't want you nor nobody else to know. I knew him back in Morris County."
Jeff was curious to hear more, but Captain Clardy himself walked up, frowning, and Sparrow scuttled back to the kitchen. 15 minutes before the supper call, each night, Captain Clardy came on an inspection tour. The surly officer liked the tasty bean soup that was served regularly at the evening meal. Twice that week, as Jeff was carrying the heavy soup kettle out of the kitchen, Clardy stopped him and, picking up a big metal spoon, lifted the lid of the kettle, scooped up a full spoonful of the delicious soup, and ate it. Next evening, Jeff was careful to be carrying a soup kettle just as Clardy came into the kitchen. As usual, Clardy stepped in front of him, blocking his way.
"Here, you," Clardy growled. "Give me a taste of that."
"Yes, sir," said Jeff with enthusiasm. Holding the bail of the heavy kettle in his left hand, he saluted smartly with his right. Selecting a large spoon and dipping deeply into the kettle, Clardy greedily downed the contents of the spoon. Quickly, he gagged and spat it out upon the floor.
"Do you call that stuff soup?"
Clardy roared, glaring angrily at Jeff.
"No, sir," said Jeff, with pretended innocence. "That's dishwater."
Clardy stamped out of the kitchen without a word. The cooks all looked alarmed.
"Lad, you best steer clear of that bucko," one old fellow warned Jeff kindly. "He's cruel and vindictive. He'll never forget that, long as he lives."
"No, I suppose not," Jeff replied. "Thank you for warning me."
But as he performed his duties about the kitchen, Jeff felt repaid for the captain's slur on his name. He did his work so well that on the sixth day he was dismissed an hour early and wandered down to the stables to see the horses. There he saw an old teamster leading half a dozen fine-looking cavalry mounts around and around the corral. The old man wore a white undershirt and blue army pants with scarlet stripes down the sides. He was muttering angrily to himself. The horses looked jaded, as if they'd been ridden hard.
Suddenly a gust of wind whipped a piece of paper across the corral. Frightened, one of the animals jerked loose from the man and started running for the open gate, his long rein dragging in the dust.
"Ho, ya black dog!" shouted the old teamster.
But the horse paid no attention. The gate was near Jeff. Quickly, he ran in front of it, raising his arms and calling to the horse soothingly. The animal plunged to a stop, eyeing Jeff distrustfully. Still talking to him, Jeff was able to recover the rein and return the horse to the teamster.
"Sir," said Jeff, saluting, "I was raised on a farm and know something about horses. I'll be glad to help you walk 'em. Why are they in such a lather?"
The old teamster must have been impressed by that "sir" and also the salute. He handed Jeff three of the halter reins.
"These dumb stable boys are no account," the sergeant growled in his rich dialect. "If I send them to the crick to water the horses, they bile the water in them on their way back."
As they walked along, Jeff stole a sidelong look at his companion and saw that the teamster was small, wiry, and had lots of wrinkles in the corners of his eyes. His face was covered with black whiskers, as though he hadn't shaved in a week. Jeff judged him to be nearly 60 years of age. Later, Jeff helped Mike Dempsey, for that was the teamster's name, to rub down the animals, return them to their stalls, and feed them. As they worked, he told Mike all about himself and about his run-in with Captain Clardy. Mike chuckled when Jeff related what he had said when ordered to fix bayonets. Without a word, the old Irishman carefully knocked the ashes out of his cob pipe and stuffed it into his side pocket. Walking into a small office in the harness room, he came out with a bayonet and an old, well-oiled rifle. He showed Jeff every command involving bayonets in the manual of arms, then gave him the gun and bayonet and began to drill him. Jeff soon got the hang of it.
"After this, me boy, you fix it, Winnie says to, whether it's broke or not," counseled Mike.
In spite of his good intentions, Jeff found out next day that a volunteer soldier serving under volunteer officers has a lot to learn about military etiquette. Henry Slaughter, a neighbor from Linn County, had joined up earlier than Jeff and secured a commission. He approached Jeff on the drill field and handed him a letter from home. Jeff knew Slaughter well. They had hunted rabbits together many times in the Bussy cornfield. Grateful, Jeff blurted,
"Thanks, Henry."
Slaughter drew himself up haughtily and cursed Jeff roundly for his familiarity, and Jeff learned that two neighbors of yesterday could today be separated by an impassable gulf when 2 bits worth of tinsel was pinned on the shoulders of one and not the other. When the men in Jeff's outfit elected their own non-commissioned officers, they chose for Sergeant Pete Milholland, a big, broad-beamed farmer with white hair and blue eyes who had homesteaded along the Kaw River near Lawrence. Jeff was surprised at the choice, since Milholland was green as a gourd about military procedure and wore his uniform in a slipshod manner. As a drill master, he must have been the worst in the regiment. His squad marched with their rifles down or held over the wrong shoulder, their coats were unbuttoned, their pants legs stuck out at their boots, and when they attempted the bayonet drill, they stuck each other repeatedly. For 3 weeks, the Kansas Volunteers marched and drilled at the fort. Jeff was afraid the war would be over before the 1st Kansas Regiment of Infantry would reach the battleground. His fear grew each day. Finally, on the 1st of July, 1861, the command was sufficiently trained to cross the Missouri River on the military ferry and bivouac in the big timber beyond. There, Jeff liked the hard, rugged training in the open. It was getting him nearer his first battle. But David Gardner liked no part of it. He never seemed to understand the commands. The officers scolded him constantly, and the other recruits hazed him. Soon, he became the loneliest volunteer in camp. Jeff helped him all he could, but David never seemed to adjust to Army life. One night, Jeff found him sobbing in his bunk.
"I'm lonesome," David blurted miserably.
I want to go home and see Ma. Gosh almighty, Jeff, I ain't cut out to be no soldier. I was a fool to ever leave the farm.
Corn, Dave, Jeff said in alarm. You can't just walk off from the army once you've joined it. That's desertion. You know the penalty for desertion. They'll stand you up against a wall and shoot you. David's